Baiting the Hook. I don't know why I did that. Or Drop Everything is a better title. Now I know at this point in the service, it's going to really shock you to learn something about me, that I really enjoy the activity of recreational, or as it's called, sport fishing. Does that shock you? This past summer, I was fishing with Laura up at Lake of the Woods, and I had my annual trip up to New Liskeard to go fishing. And over the years, I have spent hours on a boat watching others catch more and bigger fish than me. I confess that I even enjoy from time to time watching those fishing shows on television, like Bob Azumi's Real Fishing Show or Fishing Canada, that sort of thing. I watch these programs about fishing with the longing to get back out there with rod and reel, and perhaps in the faint hope that I could get some new tip or strategy to land the big one. Not the branch, but a big one. And I am also, I readily admit, addicted to Bass Outfitters store in Vaughan, Ontario. And I have been in there so many times that it's been a real problem, because it could break the bank with the stuff that I buy that I never use. And I found out the ideal marketing situation if you want to get me in your store. You put Bass Outfitters right beside the Cortland Bakery and you've got me for life. I'll never come home. Now, over the years, I have tried deep sea fishing, believe it or not. I've deep sea fished in Florida, South Carolina, PEI, and a highlight, halibut fishing in Alaska with Laura. And of course, freshwater fishing. I've even spent, I know you'll love this, I spent a very romantic Valentine's Day ice fishing with Laura on Lake Simcoe. And I'm happy to report that she said she enjoyed the experience. And she'd do it again, but not on Valentine's Day. I do know as a fisherman that I'm a bit brighter than two fellows I heard about who came up from the southern United States and decided they'd come to Canada and do some ice fishing. The two friends made great plans to travel up to Canada and to a lake that was known for its superb ice fishing. When they arrived at the Outfitters, they discovered they needed an ice auger to drill holes in the ice so they could get at the fish. It was an expensive purchase, but they were determined to get the ice fishing done correctly. And after drilling a hole, the two men sat down on their chairs and dropped their lines into the hole. Well, it wasn't very long until a man approached them and said to them, "You won't find any fish in that hole." Well, they thought, well, obviously this man's a local. He knows his stuff. So they packed everything up and they moved on to a new location and they drilled another hole and threw their lines down. Sure enough, the man came again and said same thing to them. "You're not going to catch anything in that hole." Well, they moved on to a third place. And sure enough, wouldn't you know, the same man came to the two anglers and said, "You're not going to catch anything in that hole." And they said, "Why do you keep telling us there's no fish in our holes?" He said, "Well, for two reasons. One, I'm the manager of this hockey arena and the lake's 2 miles down the road." As I said, I hope if I ever get a chance to ice fish again, I'll be brighter than those two fellas. I do understand, and Floyd and I actually have talked about this because he's quite an avid fisherman too, the inherent danger related to fishing to one's spiritual health. After all, the proverb states, "I fish, therefore I lie." But perhaps my interest in fishing is behind my affinity with the disciples, who were fishermen. Namely, the four that mentioned in the gospel text today, there's Peter, there's Andrew, James, and John. Although, unlike myself, who fishes for recreation, these four men, they fished to support their families. It was their job. With no modern equipment like fish finders, which don't work, by the way, outboard motors, these rugged men every day spent hours being tossed about on the Sea of Galilee with round nets that were about 10 to 15 feet across, out in the open water in the hopes of catching something. And unlike modern trawler nets, this fishing method rarely caught any more than a handful of fish at a time. That makes Peter's experience of the nets full to overflowing in Luke's account even more amazing. The location of our gospel lesson, the Sea of Galilee, is an inland freshwater lake. It's called the Sea of Galilee, but it's actually a lake. It's only 12 miles in length and 6 miles across at its widest point. Lake Erie is considerably bigger than that. Although small, Galilee, at least in Jesus' day, it teemed with life. Well, sadly, I found a news story from back in 2010, and things haven't changed a whole lot, in which Israeli authorities banned all fishing, recreational and commercial, in the Sea of Galilee because of depleted fish stocks in that lake. Several fish species were actually in danger of extinction. Now, that sounds like our East Coast stock or a cod stock problem. In Jesus' day, there were numerous species of fish in that lake, some species which could be found nowhere else in the entire world. And you can find that out from Josephus, the historian. There's actually one species of fish in that lake called St. Peter's fish. Can you figure out why that's called that? It's after that story of Peter finding the coin in the fish's mouth to pay the taxes. It's actually a kind of tilapia, if you're really interested. Now, the abundance of fish back centuries ago gave rise to several fishing villages that popped up along the shores of the lake. And generations of the families going back thousands of years caught and sold fish out of that lake. And that was the case for the four disciples that we meet in our passage today. Andrew and Peter were brothers. James and John were also brothers. And they're recorded as having fished all day with their father Zebedee. Now into this routine fishing scene enters Jesus. And everything changes. At first reading, the calling of the disciples seems like a very peculiar story to me. The men are going about their daily business and Jesus approaches them and says what? Come follow me and I will make you fishers of men or people. I know in some versions the Bible says, come be my disciples, but the literal rendering of this passage is, come follow me. But the other version is correct too. Because the intention of Jesus' words is that these men will come and be his disciples. The call of Jesus is clear. To follow him is to become a disciple. But consider what happened here. These four men were in the middle of their regular work. And Jesus calls them, and they simply put everything down and follow him. James and John left their father with the hired servants. That point's added as well by Mark. Anyway, these four men, they get up, they leave their nets, they leave their boats and all their gear, and they walk away with Jesus. Now, imagine if that happened today. You're busy going about your job, and suddenly Jesus comes along and says, hey, come follow me. What do? How can you leave your work undone? Your nets left unattended, but not even having properly cleaned them or mend them. Perhaps we might make up an excuse not to follow. And Heraclius, it's not just excuses. They're actually quite reasonable ones. But Jesus, I've got things to do. I got places to go and people to see. I got a family to feed. Now, I have several questions about the story. I have for many years. What in the world motivated these men? What did their families think? If they are gone, who pays the bills? Who catches the fish? Perhaps we're missing something here. What we might overlook is the sense of urgency in Jesus' call. This is not a mere teacher-disciple relationship that I talked about last week. Because there's a critical phrase used in this passage. I will make you fishers of men or fishers of people. Now, if we take that phrase to be just a kind of clever play on words and the situation these men find themselves in, we fail to appreciate the power of that image. That phrase, fishers of men, is actually from the Old Testament prophets. Did you know that? It spoke of God's judgment and the calling of his people. Jeremiah 16, 15 to 16 reads, "For I will bring them back to this land that I gave their ancestors, but now I am sending for many fishermen who will catch them." Ezekiel 29 verse 4 reads, "I will put hooks in your jaws and drag you out on the land with fish sticking to your scales." Now, mind you, those prophetic passages, they have a distinctly ominous tone to them because, well, they're stressing the judgment of God. And just like fish are caught and sorted, with the valuable ones being kept and the unwanted ones being disposed of, God will gather us in and judge us whether we are worthy of the kingdom. In the ancient community of Qumran, and these are the people that actually wrote and preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls, they saw their duty as passing the message of judgment on to the people as a way of being God's fishermen. One Dead Sea fragment reads, "And thou hast set me in a place of exile among many fishers that stretch a net on the face of the water, and among hunters set among the sons of perversity." These four fishermen on the Sea of Galilee, they would have been aware of that concept of fishers of men. And I'm strongly sure that they likely had already heard Jesus talk. They already knew at least a little bit about who he was. They knew he was at least a teacher. The immediate function of the fishers of men is to accompany Jesus as witnesses to the proclamation of the nearness of the kingdom and the necessity for people to turn to God through radical repentance. They are to go out and confront people with God's kingdom. The point should also be made in Mark's account that Jesus has a supreme and sovereign authority to call anyone he wants. And our response, you and I, is to be like those four men on the Sea of Galilee. We are to respond, excuse me, with radical obedience. To be fishers of people, we have to follow Jesus. There are lots of passages in the Bible that talk about the radical, all-consuming nature of discipleship. But there's one in Luke 14, 25 to 26 that really stands out. Great crowds were following Jesus, the passage says. He turned to them and he said to them, "If you want to be my follower, you must love me more than your mother and father, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, more than your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple." I guess I think that what really unsettles me about Jesus' call is that over time, especially in the Western world, we've watered down the radical nature of it. We've accepted that Jesus does call people, well, at least he calls ministers and missionaries, but we temper it with all kinds of conditions and qualifications. We might like to say to ourselves and to each other that Jesus never really meant us to literally love our families less than him or leave our livelihoods to follow him. Not even Jesus would expect that. Thinking about Jesus' radical call makes me at least mindful that maybe we're more like the rich young ruler than we would care to admit. Even if we are good people, doing all the right things for our family and neighbors, we still love money and fame and privilege more than Jesus. You know, it's no wonder, I think, that Jesus called fishermen and not Pharisees to follow him. Although I think the invitation was open to them as well, if they wanted to. Pharisees were religious specialists who believed they knew what was best and what God's kingdom was all about. They were not open to the radical nature of the kingdom being ushered in with Jesus. Although the fishermen struggled to comprehend everything Jesus did and said, they were still willing to try and see things differently. And certainly after Christ's resurrection, the whole kingdom enterprise became a whole lot clearer in their minds and their hearts. Maybe our hearts are too cluttered to accept the radical call of Jesus. Maybe we hear Christ calling us and think first about what we perceive we will lose or worry about what our families will say. What would my parents, and spouse, and children, or even grandchildren say if I did some radical thing for God? What if I left my current job and headed off with Christ leading me on some adventure of faith? Now, I can guess what our first response might be. Now, come on, Daryl. Jesus was just being metaphorical. Really? I think we have become so comfortable in our Western spirituality that we forget how costly faith really is. In Mark 13, Jesus is more than blunt about the cost of following him. He talks of the time coming when allegiance to him will cost us everything we have. This is what he says there. You will be handed over to the courts and beaten in the synagogues. You will be accused before governors and kings of being my followers. Brother will betray brother to death. Father will betray their own children. Children will rise against their parents and cause them to be killed. And everyone will hate you because of your allegiance to me. Wow. I think Jesus was trying to be really clear in letting us know that true, radical, life-consuming discipleship will lead to some serious consequences for all of us. It's not enough to turn some away, and some did turn from Jesus. In fact, I wonder how many others were on that beach that day when Jesus walked along the shoreline and they refused to heed his call. True discipleship at some level seeks an abandonment of ourselves and those things that we cling to with tight grips. Things that we think give our lives eternal meaning, but really are just finite things. C.S. Lewis, many of you have heard of him. He wrote in Mere Christianity about the true nature of Jesus' call to us when he writes this. He's pretending he's speaking for Jesus, and he says, "Give me all. I don't want so much of your time and so much of your money and so much of your work. I want you. I've not come to torment your natural self, but to kill it. No half measures are any good. I don't want to cut off a branch here and a branch there. I want to take down the whole tree. I don't want to drill the tooth or crown it or stop it, but I want to have it out. Hand over the natural self. All the desires which we think are innocent as well as the ones you think are wicked, the whole outfit. And I will give you a new self instead. In fact, I will give you myself. My own will shall be yours." I put another way. I remember some time ago hearing a quotation that really made me stop and great conviction, actually. I don't remember who said it, but the words have haunted me for a very long time. If we were arrested for being Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict us? You see, discipleship means a complete overhaul of our lives. It means clearing out of our worldviews, our ideas, our habits, our values, our relationships, everything. It's a scary prospect. I know that. And yet, it's the only path to an abundant life. I'm mindful of an incident from, here's Daryl again, an incident from the film Men in Black. It's an older film now. About an underground agency that protects the earth from dangerous extraterrestrials. And Agent K, who is Tommy Lee Jones, or played by Tommy Lee Jones, and Agent J, played by Will Smith, a hotshot New York cop partner to eliminate a villainous alien, which is called a bug. Which in actual fact is a very large talking cockroach, of all things. Before Agent J relinquishes his police badge to join the Men in Black, Agent K explains the scenario for him. Because Jay is still unsure of what exactly the agency does and what the agency wants of him. So Agent K explains it this way. All right, here's the deal. At any given time, there are around 1,500 aliens on the planet. Most of them are right here in Manhattan. Most are decent enough. They're just trying to make a living. Humans, for the most part, don't have a clue. But Agent J asks, but why the big secret? Humans are smart. They can handle it. Agent K answers, a person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it. 1,500 years ago, everybody knew the earth was the center of the universe. 500 years ago, everyone knew the earth was flat. And 15 minutes ago, you knew that people were alone in the universe. With a sigh, Agent K says, imagine what you'll know tomorrow. So Jay asks, what's the catch? The catch? K says, the catch is that you will sever every human contact. No one will ever know you existed anywhere, ever. And K pauses and adds, I'll give you till sunrise to think it over. As K walks away, Jay shouts, hey, is it worth it? Oh yeah, it's worth it, Kay says, if you're strong enough. Being Christ's disciple means severing the ties we have to our old lives. That's it. Maybe not all of them, but certainly the ones that will remain are going to be fundamentally changed. You will not be the same. With Christ as our teacher, we will see everything differently. Our worldview will be altered permanently. We may be asked by him to leave our nets and just follow, despite the consequences. And I know what you're dying to ask. I do. Is it worth it? And I'd say, yeah, it's worth it. Not because we're strong enough, but because he's strong enough. So are you ready, willing, and able to respond? To put down your nets when Jesus calls? I hope so.